Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
In 1967, the ABA, American Basketball Association, launched with teams in such cities as Louisville, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, and Oakland. The 11-team league also put a franchise in Pittsburgh, the Pipers. After a bumpy start, the Pipers jumped on the shoulders of future Hall of Famer Connie Hawkins and rode those shoulders all the way to the first championship title in ABA history. And next, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to take a look back at some of the history of the ABA and the Pipers with basketball historian and author Mark Whiting.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shaped the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode 127, The Pittsburgh Pipers. Now, not only are we going to talk about the colorful history of the Pipers' first season in the ABA, we will also explore some of the history of creating the ABA and much more about the league's first season. My guest today is Mark Whited. Mark has been hard at work writing a new book about the Pipers that is due out by the end of the year. He is a wealth of knowledge. And Mark and I actually lost track of time and could have spoken for so much longer. In fact, I'm going to have Mark back on in the near future to talk more in depth about the Pipers' young star, Connie Hawkins, who was unfairly suspended. He was actually blackballed from the NBA for years. But when he did get to the NBA, he certainly made up for lost time very quickly. The Pipers were quite some team. They put together a few impressive winning streaks, won the East, and then they marched through the playoffs all the way to a thrilling seven-game championship series in which they ultimately prevailed over the New Orleans Buccaneers, a team that featured Doug Moe and Larry Brown. Mark and I discuss it all right here on Sports Forgotten Heroes. Hey, you can also watch Sports Forgotten Heroes on YouTube. Don't forget, you can also listen to Sports Forgotten Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can, please give Sports Forgotten Heroes a 5-star rating. And if you're feeling up to it, a nice sentence or two. Follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Facebook and look for Sports Forgotten Heroes on X at Sports F Heroes. As always, thanks for listening and thanks for your support. So, the Pittsburgh Pipers, led by Connie Hawkins, and a team that featured several other fantastic hoopsters, guys like Art Heyman, Chico Vaughn, and Charlie Williams, they went 54-24 in their first year and, like I said, won the ABA championship, the first in the league's history. But after winning the title, they packed up and left Pittsburgh for Minnesota. It was a crazy 5-year existence for this team, and here to tell us more about it is my special guest, Mark Whiting. Hey Mark, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. So glad you could be here. I see your sport and you are Pittsburgh.
I got my Condor shirt on. In the background, I have a Pipers golf shirt. So, and various books here in the background that were useful in my research.
I'm sure. And we'll get into the Condors as well. Obviously, we're going to talk, start off with the Pipers. What an interesting topic. And I guess we'll just start right there. Who were the Pittsburgh Pipers?
Who were the Pittsburgh Pipers? Well, they were one of the 11 original teams in the American Basketball Association during the 1967-68 season. One of 11. And then there's so many different unique things, but one very unique thing about them is they lasted for 5 years, and each of their 5 years they had a new logo. Seriously, now think about it. In the kind of podcast you do, it's forgotten teams, forgotten players, all that sort of thing. Try and think of some team, any old basketball, baseball, football, hockey team that had a new logo each year of existence, and especially if it lasts 5 years and have five different logos.
Yeah. Now today, what do? They make these City Connect, these alternate uniforms and all. So they mess around that way. But no, I cannot think of another team that had a different logo basically every year of its existence. It's pretty interesting.
Well, I'll tell you real quick. So first year, the Pittsburgh Pipers, they won the championship, moved to Minnesota. Second year, they were the Minnesota Pipers. Then third year, they moved back to Pittsburgh. They were Pittsburgh Pipers again with a new logo, not the first Pittsburgh. And then after that third year, they changed their name to the Condors. And then after 1 year of the Condors, they decided to change their logo again, new ownership and all that. So anyway.
Well, the ABA was a colorful league. I mean, the red, white, and blue basketball, colorful players. Tell us about the ABA a little bit. Tell us how it came to be and why start a new basketball league back in 1967-68?
Well, the guys who started it, remember the AFL started in 1960, mm-hmm. and was a big success.
Sure was.
And so actually a guy named Dennis Murphy, how it was happening. So in New York, there was a guy named Connie Sheridan interested in starting a new basketball league, but he was looking at it from a marketing angle. He really had no idea about basketball that much really, but he thought he could make a bunch of money marketing. In fact, he was going to have a league where he was going to be in charge of marketing for each team. So he had a really weird idea about things. But at the same time, a guy in California named Dennis Murphy, he and a guy who used to play quarterback for USC, I'm forgetting his name at the moment, but they wanted to get an AFL team in Anaheim. Well, that's almost exactly the time they were thinking about that. The NFL and AFL decided to merge, and they knew that they weren't going to allow two teams in the LA area, the Rams and then the team in Anaheim. So they said, to heck with that idea. And then they said, well, why not start a basketball league? And it's really, back then things like that happened on the fly. Nowadays, you'd take years of research and thinking about it before it could happen. But anyway, they got Connie Sheridan in New York and Dennis Murphy the year before, 1966, this all started to come together. They actually worked together briefly for a month or two. And then once they got some people interested, they all realized they needed to get rid of Connie Sheridan, the New York angle, and that because this guy wanted to charge so much for each franchise just to do their marketing. So anyway, they got rid of him and pulled together groups in Indianapolis, Louisville, Denver. Well, actually Kansas City first, Pittsburgh. They wanted a New York team, but they wound up putting it across the river in New Jersey because they really didn't have a venue in New York. And New Orleans, Houston, Dallas, Oakland, and Anaheim. So, and you notice all those cities are cities that did not have NBA teams, except Anaheim was, down the road from the LA Lakers, and the New Jersey Americans were across the river from the Knicks.
Yeah. So they put these teams in those places, and you know, it always interests me how they discover or how they decide on a particular location. For instance, Pittsburgh. What made them think that putting a team in Pittsburgh or New Orleans or Minnesota, what made them think, what kind of market studies did they do to make them think that a team will succeed there?
I don't think they did a whole lot of studying. but now a place like Pittsburgh, you know, right away you're going to think, oh man, they always failed in basketball, professional basketball. Well, they did open the 6 years before that, the Civic Arena. The Civic Arena, when it opened in 1961, was practically the eighth wonder of the world in a way, because it was the first arena which opened in the history of arenas. Mm. And actually, up until the mid-60s, the city of Chicago, for instance, failed more times than Pittsburgh with pro basketball. If you go back to the origins of the NBA, the National Basketball League, the Midwest Basketball Conference, and the American Basketball League of 1925 to 1931. Actually, Chicago had more failures than Pittsburgh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, well, let's talk a little bit about the origins of the NBA, because obviously that plays a role in this as well. If I follow correctly, the NBA is actually the combination of two leagues, the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America, and they came together to form the NBA. And the competition between the two was somewhat fierce. But talk about the competition, if you can, between those two leagues and why they ultimately decided to merge.
Well, that's a very good question. So in 1949, the National Basketball League and the Basketball Association of America merged. Well, the BAA was formed just 3 years before that. So you've got sort of two tracks going back in history. So the BAA was formed in 1946, just 3 years before that. And the reason they made a perfect match is the BAA had the arenas. The National Basketball League actually had the better players. Mm. But the BAA formed because, if you take it a few steps backwards, the Arena Managers Association was actually the organization that started the BAA. And that was a guy named John Harris in Pittsburgh, and Walter Brown. Harris was the first president. Walter Brown in Boston was the vice president. Uh-huh. Well, John Harris was the guy who started the Ice Capades. So through World War II, the Ice Capades and hockey, the NHL and the AHL, kept the big arenas in Boston, New York, St. Louis, Detroit, going because of the Ice Capades and hockey. Well, one day after World War II was done, they sort of were sitting around, and one said to the other, "Do you know anything about this basketball thing? You know, we have empty nights at the arenas. Exactly. Let's start a basketball league."
I think, and that's how it could be. I got to interrupt, Mark. I think people would be very surprised to learn, as you are about to tell us, that hockey was the sport in the arenas, and basketball was the afterthought. Geez, we have so many empty nights in our arena. What are we going to do to put fannies in the seats and make some money? Hey, I heard of this thing, basketball. Let's make a basketball league.
Well, right. And actually, you can take it a step further. The NBA should they've never recognized Sonia Henie. You know who Sonia Henie was?
Sure.
Yeah, the ice skating Olympic champion in the 20s and 30s.
Well,
good old John Harris in Pittsburgh, he had owned an AHL team in Pittsburgh called the Hornets. and he had it since the mid-30s. Well, in 1936, Sonia Henie, after she'd won her third time in the Olympics, won the gold medal again, well, she wanted to be a movie star. So, and she was from Norway, so she came to the United States to become a movie star. Well, she did a bunch of ice skating performances, and John Harris had her perform for a Pittsburgh Hornets AHL game in March of 1936, and it was an incredible success beyond all belief. And he scratched his head and thought, I think there's some money to be made in this. And he didn't actually, Sonia Henie never skated for the Ice Capades itself. She actually skated for the Ice Follies. You may have heard them too.
Sure.
But he got the idea that something could be made out of this. Well, he's the guy that in 1940 got the Ice Capades going. And it was an incredible success beyond all belief for about 25 years. He made money. It was an incredible success, and he was quite the promoter. So actually, you know, if you think about it, the arena managers, they organized the BAA in 1946, but it was actually the Ice Capades in hockey that got him through World War II and kept the arenas going and open and all that sort of thing. So they wouldn't have had the money to do all that in 1946. But there was this other track, the National Basketball League. And you mentioned that. Well, they actually had the better players. The National Basketball League went back to people will say, it started in 1937. Well, actually, it started 2 years before that as the Midwest Basketball Conference. Sounds like a college football conference or something, right?
It's sort of like the All-America Football Conference.
Yeah, right. So anyway, they decided the name didn't sound too well, so they changed it to National Basketball League in 1937. But in 1935, Pittsburgh was in it, Chicago, Akron, Columbus, and then Indianapolis, Detroit, Buffalo. So it stretched from Buffalo to Chicago, and over the years it was in Oshkosh, Anderson, Indiana, places like that, not the major cities, but big enough cities to keep something like that going. And from 1935 to 1949, they had the better players. Now, also going on at the time was the actual best teams were barnstorming teams throughout the 1920s and 30s. The original Celtics, the New York Rens and all black team, the Harlem Globetrotters, the Philadelphia Spahs, a Jewish team, and some other barnstorming teams. And I'll take it one step further. So in 1935, the NBC was formed. Well, actually, 10 years before that, in 1925, was the first national major basketball league. And it was called the American Basketball League. It stretched from Boston to Chicago. It was started by a guy in Cleveland called Rosenbaum, and he had a team called the Cleveland Rosenbaums, another barnstorming team. And so from 1925 to 1931, they had teams in Washington, Boston, Cleveland, Chicago, a few other places, not Philadelphia, though, strangely enough. And it lasted for 6 years and did pretty well, but it got killed off by the Depression.
Interesting. So earlier you had said that Chicago failed more than Pittsburgh. So there were, prior to the Pipers, there were professional basketball teams that did play in Pittsburgh?
Yeah. So the Pittsburgh Wrens were in the American Basketball League from 1961 until the end of 1962. That's why Connie Hawkins would have never played for the Pipers. He would have never played in the NBA, would not be in the Hall of Fame if it hadn't been for the American Basketball League forming in 1961. And this was right after Connie got unjustly dragged into that point-shaving scandal. Pittsburgh got a team. He was able to play for Pittsburgh, which enabled him to be around a few years later to play for the Pipers of the ABA. And the reason he was able to do that is because he got married while he was in Pittsburgh the first time around, met the two lawyers that took his case, and later got him into the NBA. Mm. Now, that ABL, people will say, oh, well, that wasn't a very high caliber play. Well, actually, it was. They had several ex-NBA players, and somebody as high level as Larry Brown said, yep, those guys were, no kidding, real players. And the reason it formed was Abe Saperstein. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. The Harlem Globetrotter guy.
Yep.
Well, he started the Harlem Globetrotters in 1927, and he pretty much kept the NBA afloat through the 1950s by having his Harlem Globetrotters play have doubleheader nights with NBA games. There'd be a Globetrotter game and an NBA game. And so that really helped the NBA survive the 50s. They weren't exactly making a lot of money in the 1950s. Right. And so he was upset. He wanted the NBA to have a team in Chicago or go to the West Coast, and he wanted to have either a team in Chicago himself or out in Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. when they went ahead and moved the Lakers to Los Angeles, that was the final straw for him in 1960. And thus he started this other league, mm-hmm. the American Basketball League.
Pittsburgh has a unique history when it comes to sports. I mean, you know, the Steelers have such a rabid fan base. The Penguins have established themselves as one of the most solid teams in the NHL and has a rabid fan base. The Pirates have a, you know, not as rabid, but when they are successful, when they're putting a team on the field that plays well, the fans, they show up, you know, and it's been home. Pittsburgh has to start up teams in several different leagues, and many people are going to find this surprising, the NHL. That's right. Prior to the original six, the NHL had several different variations. In 1925-26, they had a team in Pittsburgh, the Pirates.
Right.
And they finished third in a 7-team league going 19-16-1. They actually played for five seasons. Pittsburgh, like I say, has a solid fan base. Their fans are rabid about their teams. So why has professional basketball been unable to stick in Pittsburgh?
Well, so what happened was, it's funny you mentioned the hockey team. So in the 20s, they had the Pittsburgh Pirates were here. So they tried like hell in the early 1930s to get a new arena built. But of course, the Depression was going, and the NHL even let Pittsburgh keep their team on suspension, even though they weren't playing for a year or two, to try and, you know, thinking that they'd get an arena built. They just couldn't do it. And they moved, of all places, Philadelphia. Not exactly the kind of thing a Pittsburgher likes to hear, right? Philadelphia, especially when it comes to hockey.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that failed. But then in the 30s, like I said, John Harris got an AHL team, the Pittsburgh Hornets, and he made it into quite a success. They won the championship at least twice, maybe three times. I'm forgetting here. But anyway, in 1940, I talked about John Harris helping start the BAA. Well, he actually had a Pittsburgh franchise that first year, 1946-47, the Pittsburgh Ironmen were here. Well, as great as John Harris was at running the ice capades, and as great as he had been in running theaters in Pittsburgh in the 20s and 30s, and as good a success as the Hornets were, he knew nothing about basketball. And so he made the mistake of making his general manager a guy who, like him, had grown up in the theater business. And they went 15-45 and were pretty much a total failure. Plus, they played in a very small venue. They played in the Duquesne Gardens, which only held 5,000 people. So it just didn't work. Ironically, a fellow named Press Maravich played for that team. And this guy named Pete Maravich was born.
Okay.
right after that season ended in Pittsburgh. But see, so in the 50s, so we had a, and actually, you know, yeah, we got the Steelers and Steeler Nation is amazing. But before the 1970s, the Pirates owned the sports scene.
Sure.
Believe it or not, they did.
I believe
it. And so you had the Pirates, the Steelers got great. And then in 1967, 68, when the Pipers came along in the ABA, well, guess what? That's the year the NHL gave Pittsburgh a team.
The Penguins. So
the Penguins were fortunate enough to just move right in onto a fan base. In fact, the Hornets won the AHL championship in 1967, right as they were being awarded the Penguin franchise. So Pittsburgh's not that big of a city. So they already had their attention on the Steelers, Pirates, and you have Penguins. You already have a fan base. Pitt basketball and Duquesne basketball, especially in the 50s, Duquesne did really well. Pitt had a rough time in the 60s. So there was a bit of a college fan base. But, you know, you get into the situation in the bigger cities where there's only so much sports you can handle. And basketball just sort of was the odd man out, you might say.
Yeah, you know, not every city can support a team in four different leagues. Let's go back to the ABA. A little more history before we dive deeper into the Pipers. The league endured for nine seasons. Four teams were absorbed by the NBA, the Nets, the Nuggets, the Pacers, and the Spurs. Now, really interesting to me is the fact that the Kentucky Colonels were one of two teams, the Pacers being the other, that actually played every season of the ABA's existence. They had a great following, and they were not absorbed by the NBA. Why is that? And by the way, you know, I do believe that there is a group in Louisville that is constantly seeking NBA expansion. So why did the NBA not add the Colonels, and why haven't they expanded to
one? Well, one simple reason why the Colonels weren't brought in, and his name was John Y. Brown.
Period.
Okay. In fact, I talked to him a couple years ago, right before he passed away. Very interesting guy. all the weird things that happened along my way here. So a guy who used to be the editor of a newspaper in Lexington, he happens to live next to my cousin in near Lexington, Kentucky. Got talking to him one day. Turns out, you know, I told him about my book. He said, oh, I know John Y. Brown. Anyway, so he talked to John Y. Brown. Well, John Y. Brown, you know, he's the guy that turned the Kentucky Fried Chicken. That's how he made his money, if you didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had a famous wife, too, if I remember.
Yes. Yeah, John Y. Brown did things a little different. And he later became governor of Kentucky. But he.
Right. For those wondering who the famous wife, Phyllis George.
Right.
One of the co-hosts of the old NFL Today show.
Right, exactly.
Wound up marrying John Y. Brown.
Right. Well, the reason John Y. Brown did not go along with the merger is, so the Nets, the Spurs, the
Nuggets and the
Nuggets, and
The Pacers.
They had to pay quite the premium to get into the NBA. It wasn't just how, gee, fellas, it's nice we're in the, you know, they had to pay quite a price. John Y. Brown didn't want to do that. He didn't think it was a financially smart, simple as that. Louisville would have been, they had a great following. They, mm-hmm. like you said, they were in all 9 years. They won a championship in 1975. They would have been able to do just as well as the Pacers or the Spurs or the Nuggets. Mm-hmm. But he didn't think it was a good financial move purely from that perspective. So he didn't do it. Okay. And then right after that, he bought the Buffalo Braves and then became the owner of the Celtics.
Right. Yeah. He and Walter Brown did a flip.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, back to the Pipers. And before we get into the inaugural season of 1967-68, just got to mention, and you sort of went through this earlier, they left after that first year for Minnesota. And then the team was reborn in 69-70 as the Pipers, then changed the name to the Pittsburgh Condors for the 70-71 season, the 71-72 season, and then they were gone again. Tell us why. After the original right. Pipers left Pittsburgh, why did the ABA give Pittsburgh another chance, and then why didn't it work out?
Well, the reason they moved to Minnesota was two stories of their first season. Of course, first on the court, they won the championship. They had Connie Hawkins, who was the best player in the league. You know, he was the best player in the world, not in the NBA, because of the scandal. Mm-hmm. But they had attendance problems from the get-go. And one of the biggest reasons was they were had most of their home games on Tuesday night and Friday night. Well, guess what? That's high school basketball night. High school basketball in Western Pennsylvania, most places, was a very big thing.
Sure.
So they had that. They literally only had one Saturday night home game during the regular season, the whole season.
Wow.
One. The Penguins had 16. Wow. Remember, the Penguins were starting that year, too. They had 16 Saturday nights. The Pipers had one.
You know, it's funny. I think the same thing happened with the Buffalo Braves, with the Buffalo Sabres. I believe that the Braves wound up getting the real short end of the stick when it came to the premium nights to host.
Could be. I don't know. I never checked that out, but
yeah,
could be. So that hurt them a lot, big time. And so just to make matters worse, this is a funny thing I didn't notice till I really, it's funny how you don't see things at first and then you do some more research and read this and read that and go, oh, wow. Well, of those 11 ABA teams, seven of the 11 teams got to open their season at home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's because they staggered the beginning of the season.
Right. Right.
So that left four teams that had to open on the road. Well, three of the, so the Pipers were one of the four teams that opened on the road. So of those four teams, the other three had at least 3 days of rest between opening on the road and having their home, their grand home opener, right? New mm-hmm. league, all that. So their home openers were big deals. So seven teams had first game of the season open at home. The other, then three teams had 3 or 4 days between road opening home. Well, the Pipers were the only team on a Monday night. They had their first game in New Jersey. Well, their home opener was the following night. So they had zero, you know, so what happened? And back, it's crazy how they traveled, but usually they would play a night game and then fly the next morning. So they here they are.
The game.
Yeah. So they opened on a Monday night in New Jersey, and they beat New Jersey. It was a great – they won. Connie Hawkins scored 34 points in front of the home folks. Charlie Williams scored 32. Two other Pipers grew up in New York, Cal Graham, Barry Leibowitz. They got to, you know, open at home, too, before their families and all that. So it was a great first night for the Pipers. Well, then they fly the next morning back to Pittsburgh and have to play their home opener that night. So, and of course, the Minnesota Muskies were well rested. They had played a few nights earlier, so heck, they were waiting. They're in Pittsburgh before the Pipers are, and the Muskies turn out to be the second best team in the well, not the second best, the one of the three best teams,
right. Right.
And so the Pipers at home opener, you know, it's a big deal. Here's a new, and they didn't even have a exhibition game at home. This was their first appearance in Pittsburgh, new league, all that. Mm-hmm. And so they played real well first half into the third quarter, and then they just ran out of gas, got blown out. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, some of the sports writers in Pittsburgh were not big basketball fans. And they just got hammered in the press the next day. Just kind of really stupid, silly, too. If you look, go read the articles, it made no sense. As though, oh, they're failures already, right? And one guy in particular named Al Abrams. It was a couple others. But and they had a a reasonable crowd. I think it was 7,000 fans there that night. And that just set the tone for the rest of the season. They never really recovered. You know, it sounds kind of silly, but it took them a long time until finally people realized, oh, this team's pretty good. And they started getting better crowds. But it really staggered them for several weeks. And of course, the Steelers were, you know, they had that problem. The Steelers were playing. Fortunately, the Pirates season had just ended. But then again, you had the Penguins. The Penguins were drawing great from the get-go. And, you know, late 60s, it wasn't like today.
Well, the original Pipers, I mean, you know, it's funny you say they got blown out and, you know, it left an impression because darn if they weren't a really good team. Take us through a little bit about building that roster. You know, they did have the one big superstar, real Hall of Fame talent, Connie Hawkins. He wound up playing for Pittsburgh. Tell us about a couple of the stars on the team, including Connie.
Well, so they started their – well, here's how they got Connie. I mentioned the Pittsburgh Wrens. Okay, so he played in the American Basketball League for the Pittsburgh Wrens, and fortunately, he married a girl. He met a girl in Pittsburgh and got married. So after the American Basketball League dissolved, he stayed in Pittsburgh because that's where his family was. And then right away, Saperstein got him onto the Harlem Globetrotters. So for 3 years, he played for the Harlem Globetrotters, and his family stayed in Pittsburgh. So he stayed in Pittsburgh. And so when the American Basketball Association came along, he already had his two lawyers who actually, one of the lawyers was a brother of the owner of the rent. So that's how he met the lawyer. And the lawyer's wife was also a lawyer. So that husband and wife team sued the NBA a year before the ABA started. So they already had a case working. So they were able to have the ABA it was sort of the wild, wild west at signing players. It wasn't real uniform. And so they were able to have the league say, yeah, okay, Connie, you know, Pittsburgh can have Connie Hawkins. He's in Pittsburgh. No problem. So, you know, because actually Oakland sort of wanted him briefly, but so if he'd have gone to some other team, he probably wouldn't have won the suit because one of the important parts of that suit against the NBA was him being able to say he lived in Pittsburgh, because if the NBA had been able to have that suit heard in New York, he probably would have lost. Because the NBA, that was sort of like their home court, you might say.
Hey, Mark, before you go deeper.
Yeah, I don't want to go too deep into that because we could talk for hours on that.
Just real briefly, what was the issue with Connie Hawkins? Just summarize why he was banned from the NBA for those people that don't know.
Right. Okay. So in 1960, so let's go back. 1951 was the second major college basketball scandal. It really rocked colleges in New York. So time goes by. Then 10 years later, another college basketball scandal. Once again, the same New York district attorney, Frank Hogan, that ran the 1951 one, was running the 1961 one. Well, the 1961, the two fixers was a guy named Jack Molinas, and his partner was a guy named Joe Hacken. Mm-hmm. Joe Hacken had been in sort of an underworld, you know, fixer kind of guy, you know, for several years. In fact, he was older than Molinas, and Jack Molinas learned from him as a young man. Well, Jack Molinas happened to be a good basketball player. He was the sixth pick of the 1953 NBA draft.
Oh, wow.
He was All-American at Columbia. He was 6 foot seven, I think it was, 6 foot seven, 6 foot eight. He was a damn good player. So anyway, guess what? He got banned from the NBA because he was fixing games. Yeah, he played for the Fort Wayne Pistons before the Pistons moved to Detroit.
Sure.
Okay. So here, and then after he gets kicked out of the NBA, he becomes, of course, a lawyer. Okay. So Matt Molinas had the perfect cover, the perfect way to groom guys, you might say, because his method would be he would carry around his sneakers. He'd go around New York and he'd play ball in Harlem, in Brooklyn, wherever there were, you know, the playground basketball in New York was big. Rucker Park, that whole thing. I don't know how much you know about Rucker Park, yeah. But yeah. So anyway, so he was able to just hang out with guys. And so he'd spot the guys that looked like colleges, and they were good enough to play in college. And so he'd help him out with money. And he'd just say, well, I'm a lawyer. I like to play ball. They had no idea he was a fixer. No idea. So in the summer of 1960, Molinas had been working on Connie and Roger Brown. Connie and Roger Brown were the two best high school basketball players in New York in 1950-1960. Connie was the most recruited player in the country. Mm-hmm. He was already, at the age of 16, he was being compared to Oscar Robertson and Wilt Chamberlain routinely.
Yeah,
Roger Brown was almost as good.
You're good.
Yeah. So anyway, Connie goes off to the University of Iowa for his freshman year. And Molinas and Molinas would show up at games where Connie was playing, where other players were playing, and he might buy him, you know, lunch or dinner or let them use his car, stuff like that. They didn't know he was a fixer. So, like I said, Connie goes off to Iowa. Roger goes off to the University of Dayton. Well, that was their freshman year. They weren't. Back then, freshmen couldn't play varsity ball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when this scandal happened in March of 1961, when it broke, there was about 45 players that were involved. Every single one of them, except Connie and Roger Brown, were varsity players. So they were either fixing games or introducing other players or whatever. But Connie and Roger hadn't even played a varsity game. They couldn't have fixed the game. So what they tried to nail Connie for was introducing players to them. Well, Connie had spent 2 or 3 years playing on all sorts of different teams around New York. It wasn't unusual for somebody to pay expenses. You know, he'd give him $20 for playing in a tournament in New Jersey, and maybe that night another one in Harlem. And so the idea that they'd say, oh, do you know anybody else can play for our turn? You know, that wouldn't be unusual for him to say, gee, well, maybe, Smith over here would play, you know. So the idea that he was introducing players for fixers was ludicrous. That wasn't happening. And also, the other thing that happened was, so Connie did not have good grades in high school. A lot of people think, oh, he had a scholarship to Iowa. Well, no, his grades weren't good enough. So the University of Iowa, and don't think Iowa's guilty, because any other college in the country back then would have done the same, were doing the same thing. They had an elaborate system of paying his tuition under the table. So he had a job at a gas station or like a tire service station, but he didn't have to show up. He'd just get paid every few weeks, and that was to cover his tuition. Well, what happened was, before he went home for Christmas, they gave him his money for the second semester before he went to Christmas. That was a big mistake. Well, he ended up spending all that money for Christmas and showing off to his friends and stuff. So when it was time to go back to Iowa, he'd run out of money. And Jack Molinas had said, well, anytime you need a little help, just give me a call. So Jack Molinas literally loaned him $200, which his brother repaid to Molinas a couple months later. So he didn't know that Jack Molinas was a fixer. He just thought he was a nice guy who was always helping, you know, he was playing with him and such. So anyway, So they tried to say he was introducing other players and that he had taken money. Well, he did take, he took a loan, which he repaid, but he wasn't the loan thinking right. Like, oh yeah, I'm getting this money because I'm going to fix a game down the road. Wasn't it at all. And so the New York District Attorney's Office, so this scandal broke in March of 1961. It wasn't until 2 months later that it was almost an, oh, by the way, like they sent somebody to a detective to Iowa because a low level fixer guy, his name was Dave Budin, in order to try and save his own ass, he just threw out a bunch of names. Oh, and he mentioned Connie Hawkins. He said that supposedly Joe Hacken, the other fixer guy, had said, well, Connie's in the bag. Well, what's that mean, right? So on that tiny, tiny little scrap, they sent this detective to Iowa, which completely ruined his life. They took him back to New York, interrogated him for 2 weeks, was never allowed to call his family, you know, didn't get a phone. This was before the Miranda rights and all that sort of thing. So, and then he was never charged with anything. University of Iowa panicked when he got back. And it wasn't because of really fixing stuff. They were more concerned about recruiting violations. So in a panic, they expelled him. And then fortunately for Connie, the American Basketball League started up that fall, which gave him a new opportunity. And then he played for the Wrens, met those lawyers who took his case, and he won while he was in the ABA.
All right, so just so Connie Hawkins on the team. Give me another two or three guys that played for the Pipers that were real difference makers.
Well, so they didn't start out with Art Haman was their number two. Well, let's put it this way: their starting lineup when the season started was Connie Hawkins, Tom Washington. Tom Washington was a rookie out of Cheney State, all black school. Ira Hards was their center. He had played at the University of New Mexico. He put the University of New Mexico on the map. He was so good at the University of New Mexico that they had to build a new arena. His name was Ira Hards, coached by Bob King. Now, funny, Ira Hards was originally going to go to Iowa to be with Connie Hawkins. But once the scandal happened, he switched and went to New Mexico. Okay, so that was the front court, Ira Hards, Tom Washington, Connie Hawkins. Then they had two guards, Charlie Williams and Chico Vaughn. Chico Vaughn had played 5 years in the NBA, was a good defender, decent shooter, but to be honest, he had a drinking problem. it kind of held him back. I'm not breaking any new information. If you read Foul, it's all through that. And then Charlie Williams, who ended up being the best guard in the league. Charlie Williams was another one that was unjustly dragged into not the 1961 scandal, but he got messed up because he played at Seattle University. And another person on that team was going to take money, and he heard about it, but he made the mistake of not telling somebody about it. Maybe. So they dragged him into it, even though he had nothing to do with it. So he was prevented from going into the NBA at first, and then he came to the Pipers because Vince Cazzetta, the coach of the Pipers, coached him at Seattle University. So that was their starting five to begin with. They had a guy named – they really had a core of six to begin with. They had another a guard named Barry Leibowitz, who turned out to be the second best passer in the league. In fact, I got my best quote of all the quotes I've got in talking to all the people I've talked to. A fellow named Hank Whitney, who played in the ABL and the ABA. He said, Barry was such a good passer, he'd find you if you were hiding. great quote. So anyway, those were the top six. Now I mentioned Barry Leibowitz because in the end, the five that won them the championship, the starting five at the very end were once again, of course, Connie. Tom Washington was still there. Charlie Williams, Chico Vaughn, they were still there. However, Ira Hards, well, before I get to Ira, first, Barry Leibowitz, the outstanding passer, got traded to the New Jersey Americans for a guy named Art Haman.
Uh-huh.
Now, Art Haman, a lot of people go, who the hell is that? Well, Art Haman was the number one pick of the 1963 NBA draft by the Knicks. The number one pick.
Wow.
He put Duke, he was the best player to ever play at Duke University up until that time. He was the NCAA Player of the Year in 1963. However, Art Haeman was also maybe the biggest flake in all four sports in the entire decade of the 1960s. he was also pals with Joe Namath, of all people.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So this was a guy that just drove coaches nuts, drove teammates nuts. He just was kind of weird. He just, I have pages of quotes of how, what a great player he was, but he just couldn't match. He could not stand not starting all the time. He grew up as sort of a spoiled kid on Long Island, was used to always being the best player on whatever team he was on. So in high school, he was the best player in the league. He went to Duke. He was the best player in Duke, ACC Player of the Year, NCAA. So he's always used to being the best.
Right.
Now, Art also happened to start one of the biggest fights ever in the history of college basketball in 1961.
Hmm.
He started a fight with Larry Brown.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, Larry Brown. Well, Larry Brown and Art grew up in the same area on Long Island. They played against each other in high school. In fact, they were going to be a package deal to go to the University of North Carolina, but Art, being the spoiled brat he was, the North Carolina coach and his stepdad got into a fight of sorts. So Art went to Duke, Larry Brown went to North Carolina. So anyway, Art Haeman, he was the rookie of the year his first year in the NBA. Then the second year, he couldn't get along with the coach. In fact, this is a great story about Art Haeman. It's the most famous card game in the history of the NBA. So in his second year, a guy named Harry Gallatin was the coach of the Knicks. Well, Harry Gallatin and Art were not getting along very well. Art was not playing much. Even though he was the rookie of the year the first year, he was down to being the number five guard his second year. And that's actually another part. He was not really – one of the reasons he didn't succeed in the NBA was he was a tweener. He played forward in college, but they tried to make him a guard. He was too slow, and that just wasn't working. But anyway, so – they were on taking a train from Baltimore to New York after a game in Baltimore against the Bullets. And Gallatin had only let Art play 2 minutes. Well, Art and some other Knick teammates had a card game going. And so Coach Gallatin came over and asked if he could join the card game. And Art said, "Nope, you won't let me play basketball in your game. I'm not going to let you play in my card game." And then he thought about it, said, "Well, no. No, we'll let you play for 2 minutes since that's how long you let me play." Well, needless to say, he didn't last much longer with the net. Truly, seriously, that's the most famous card game in NBA history. But by the third season, he got waived. San Francisco Warriors picked him up. They traded him to Cincinnati. So he lasted a few weeks there. Then he went to Philadelphia, lasted a few weeks there. Ended up in the Eastern League for the rest of that season. And then he got another chance with the Boston Celtics 66-67 season, which happened to be Bill Russell's first season as the player coach.
Okay.
And one of the most bizarre thing, I've actually skipped a couple of bizarre things with Art to get to this one. So he went to training camp. He seemed to be getting along with people okay. He played well in the exhibition games, but when it came down to the final cut, it was between him and this guy named Ronnie Watts. Ronnie Watts had also played in the ACC. He was a pretty good ACC player, but pretty much rode the bench his entire time in the NBA. Bill Russell literally told Art he had made the team. So Art goes into the locker room all excited. But then he goes to talk to Ronnie Watt to tell him he did not make the team. But then somehow or another, Bill Russell, in his conversation with Watts, changed his mind and decided to keep Watts, and then had to tell Art. I mean, bizarre. I mean, I've never even heard of something like that before.
Well, yeah.
But it's the sort of thing that would happen to Art Haman. So anyway, so what happens? Art Haman starts out with the New Jersey Americans. 23 games into the season, the Pipers were kind of struggling along. They were 11-12. Tom Washington had gotten hurt in the second game of the season. He was the guy who would run through a brick wall, good rebounder, good defender. So they struggled because of that. And so they made one of the greatest trades in the history of trades. They traded Leibowitz to New Jersey for Art Haman. Mm. Well, Art Haman was, once again, you could spend all night on Art Haman. Well, Art Haman, a couple of things led to his being traded. The coach of New Jersey was a guy named Max Zaslavsky. At one point, Zaslavsky got thrown out of a game. He was a coach. So Art and a guy named Mel Knoll, who played at Ohio State with Jerry Lucas and John Havlicek, the coach had Art and Knoll coach the team for the rest of the game. Well, New Jersey won the game. So after the game, the reporters were asking Art Haman, well, why'd you win? What was the turning point of the game? And he said, well, when the coach got thrown out and I took over coaching. Not exactly the right answer. And then a week later, the New Jersey was in Pittsburgh of all places. And Art Haman and Mel Knoll got into a fight in the locker room. So New Jersey was all ready to trade him. So they traded him to the Pipers. And immediately the Pipers went on a 15-game winning streak. Because Art Haman, he had two very, very good skills. First of all, he was fearless. He was 6'5", but he had made his living driving into crowds. He would drive into a crowd, and he was an incredibly good passer. So he'd always get a lot of attention on him as he was driving to the basket, and invariably somebody would be open. So when he came to the Pipers, he was the perfect missing link. The coach had been looking for a swingman so Art could play forward or guard. He normally played forward for the Pipers, and he made all the difference in the world. They went on a 15-game winning streak, and they had another winning streak of 12 games not long after that. So he ended up being on the starting five at the end.
Yeah, how good were the Pipers? I mean, after all, they finished the year first in the East. You said they started the season off at 11-12. They finished the year at 54-24. They swept the Pacers in the first round of the playoffs 3-0. They beat, ironically, the Minnesota Muskies 3-1 in the second round. And then
4-1,
I'm sorry. And then they beat the New Orleans Buccaneers 4-3 in a tough 7-game ABA championship tilt. New Orleans, a team that had Larry Brown and Doug Moe on it.
Right.
Two big names. How good were the Pipers?
The Pipers were very good because they had the perfect combination. First of all, they had Connie Hawkins.
Right.
You know, that first 23 games, they struggled along at 11-12. And some of the writers say, oh, he looks listless and he looks like he's hardly trying. Well, those first 23 games, he was averaging 23 points a game and about 13 rebounds a game. You know, so he was.
Yeah.
Without looking like
he's listless.
He was a lot of what I, a lot of people who I talked to, and you can see it online. The thing people would say, Connie Hawkins was Dr. J before Dr. J.
Wow.
And no less an authority than Dr. J told me that in person.
Wow.
Because a lot of people will say, Well, Connie Hawkins was Dr. J with a jump shot. So you, part of, and actually the part where I'm writing about now is, you could almost say, I mean, Dr. J was incredible because, you know, he was such a good dunker. He was a good passer. They had the big, they both had big hands.
Mm-hmm.
Connie Hawkins' hands were 11 by 10 and a half, 11 inches long, or I'm sorry, wow. 11 inches like that, 10 and a half long. So, and Dr. J too. There's also another truism, I call them, is there's this linkage chain of Elgin Baylor to Connie Hawkins to Dr. J to Michael Jordan. Guys who played above the rim, the high flyers, those four. And there's nobody else in the 1960s plugged in there instead of Connie, even though he was robbed of 5 years of NBA time. And there's nobody, it's always those four. And wow. So that gives you an idea how good he was. So they also were good shooters. Charlie Williams and Chico Vaughn were pretty good shooters. This was the first year of the three-point shot. And just to, I'll give you an idea of the three-point shot then and now. I think I read this right. Last season, the Golden State Warriors averaged 43 three-point attempts per game. 43.
Okay.
If I'm wrong, let me know. The Pipers, who shot more, had more three-point attempts than any other team, averaged 10.
Wow.
The Dallas Chaparrals averaged 1.5.
Wow.
So what? The only weakness, so Charlie Williams, he was an all-pro guard, the ABA all-pro team guard. He was the best guard in the league. He was really quick. He was a really good defender. And he wasn't a great shooter, but he was a good shooter, and he was one of the best three-point shooters. Chico Vaughn, the other guard, took the second most three-point shots in the league. Well, the only weakness those guys had was sometimes Charlie and Chico, and even Charlie admitted it to me when I went down to Florida and interviewed him. Sometimes Charlie and Chico fell in love with the three-point shot and kind of forgot Connie was there. I mean, Connie was the bread and butter. And so Art Haman, like I said, he was one of the two forwards. He was the perfect guy, even though he had all those personality problems with the Knicks and every other team he was with. He fit in perfectly with the Pipers because, number one, he knew Connie Hawkins from New York. He played against and with Connie, well, you know, in high school. All kinds of different teams they play. Like I said before, it was a team called the New York Gems. I guess you'd call them, like, today in today's world, travel teams, AAU teams. Mm-hmm. We didn't really have that then, but that's the closest thing. So mm-hmm. Art Haman knew Connie from back in the day in New York. And so the idea that he could play with Connie Hawkins fit perfectly into Art Haman's world. He did not mind being second fiddle because he knew how great Connie Hawkins was.
Mm.
And ironically, Haman played with Willis Reed with the Knicks, Oscar Robertson with Cincinnati, and Will Chamberlain in Philadelphia, and Bill Russell in Boston. So crazy is, they called him Crazy Artie. They also called him King Arthur. The coach liked to call him King Arthur. So anyway, he was able to forget that he was usually top dog. He knew Connie Hawkins was top dog, so he accepted his role. Of course, he was starting all the time, too. It wasn't like he was sitting on the bench. So he fit perfectly. Then Tom Washington, the other forward, worked so well because he was a good defender. He was a good rebounder. And he, like I said, he was the guy that could run through a brick wall. He didn't need any individual honors, although ironically, because Connie Hawkins was a great passer himself. Connie Hawkins did not mind passing at all, even though he led the league.
He averaged about 4 to 5 assists a game.
Yeah, and the assists were counted differently than they are now. It was harder to get an assist back then. Mm-hmm. But so he was Connie was a very good passer. So Tom Washington led the league in 2-point shooting percentage, field goal percentage. Mm-hmm. He was not a good shooter, but he was open so often because number one, they would pay attention to Connie. Art Hamlin was drawing guys to him when he would drive the lane. Tom Washington would be standing there all by himself off to the side. And so he made 2-pointer after 2-pointer. And so, when Connie Hawkins was hurt a few times during the season, Tom Washington was the guy that was getting 24 rebounds. He just did whatever was necessary to win the game. He was the guy who would cry after a loss or cry after a win in happiness. He was just that dedicated of a player. And then in the end, they had they got a guy named Jim Jarvis as their after they traded Barry Leibowitz. Well, actually, they got Jim Jarvis right before they traded Barry Leibowitz. But he settled in perfectly as a number three guard. He was an All-American at Oregon State. He was in the early 60s, he was compared to Bob Cousy all the time because he was a good ball handler and passer himself, good defender, fit in perfectly as a number three guard. And then a guy named Steve Vasendak. Here's a guy who was, Steve Vasendak. He ended up being the Pipers' number five guard. He would have been either their starter or number three guard. But right during training camp, he got drafted and had to go serve in the Army for 6 months. So he missed a good part of the season, but they did bring him back after he was done, and he ended up being the number five guard. Now, the reason Steve Vasendak is so interesting, he later in life was the guy who, as the assistant athletic director at Duke, 1980, he became the assistant athletic director at Duke, and they said, Steve, find us a coach. He's the guy that found Coach K for Duke.
There you go.
I gave a speech recently for they honored him in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He's from Scranton, Pennsylvania, so they had a big banquet for him.
You know, we could go on.
We're running out of time already, aren't we?
We didn't
even get to the playoffs.
Well, what I want to do is I want to have you back on at some point to talk about Connie Hawkins. But what I do want to do, I want to close up our show today with this. They beat New Orleans in the ABA finals. And then, ironically, this is a team that wins the ABA championship. They win the championship and they leave town. The irony here is they leave town and they move to Minnesota. And they beat Minnesota in the playoffs. Minnesota left and went to Miami. So why did Minnesota leave to go to Miami, and why did Pittsburgh leave to go to Minnesota? If Minnesota was for the what made Minnesota so attractive to Pittsburgh?
George Mikan. Period. George Mikan was the commissioner of the ABA. He was in Minneapolis. He was the first superstar in the NBA for the Minneapolis Lakers. So. When they made him, so George Mikan, oh my goodness, we could have a whole thing. So George Mikan was responsible for the Lakers back in the 50s, not drafting Bill Russell. Right. And in 1969, he was responsible for the ABA not getting Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Wow.
Okay. Now, he gave the ABA credibility when it started. Right at the very beginning. He's the guy that came up with the red, white, and blue ball, and he insisted on a 3-point shot. All great things. He was incredible for getting the league started. But anyway, as part of being the commissioner, he insisted that the league offices be in Minneapolis.
Oh, boy.
So that first season, the Muskies, as good as they were, they were a very similar city to Pittsburgh in that they had an NFL team, a Major League Baseball team, and a first-year NHL expansion team.
Just come in.
Okay, right. So they were the only two cities with that sort of thing going on. Well, as bad as the Pipers' attendance was, the Muskies was worse. They actually drew worse. Plus, their arena was located away from downtown. It was in Bloomington.
Remember how the Vikings it's sort of like an half underground arena. I remember it's where the North Stars played as well.
Yeah, back then. Yeah. Anyway, the Civic Arena is downtown Pittsburgh, but their venue was away from. So anyway, they did not draw well. So the owner of the Muskies decided to move the team to Miami. Well, that left a vacancy in Minnesota. Gabe Rubin, the owner of the Pipers, wasn't happy with his attendance, and apparently he wasn't able to get a radio deal for the next season. Mm. So Mikan stepped in, and I think saw to it that Bill Erickson, the guy who got the team in Minnesota, got some money to bring the team to Minnesota. Gabe Rubin made some money on that deal, although he stayed a part of the ownership, so that when the Pipers failed miserably in attendance the second year in Minnesota and moved back, it was because Gabe Rubin was still, and the league in effect gave the team back to him.
Yeah, it's just so weird. You start in Pittsburgh, you go to Minnesota, then you come back to Pittsburgh. Not only do you come back to Pittsburgh, you come back as the Pipers, and then you change your name to the Condors.
Well, after 1 year, right. So Gabe Rubin hung on as long as he could, because all those guys were hoping for a merger to happen. So once he realized the merger was not coming, and actually there was a plan early on where every single team in the ABA was going to merge into the NBA, but none other than Oscar Robertson kind of stopped all that, because he was the president of the NBA Players Association at the time, and he knew that lots of guys were making a lot of money because of the leagues fighting each other. And so it took five more years till the merger happened. So they moved to Minnesota purely because of George Mikan. And then George Mikan ended up after the second year leaving because, like I said, he failed to get Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He had a $1 million check in his pocket when they went to negotiate. See, Jabbar was looking at either going to the NBA or the ABA. With the ABA, he would have been able to play in New York, his home, where he grew up. But the ABA owners got together, got $1 million together, gave him a check to literally give to the Jabbar team, and he failed to get it out of his pocket during their meeting, literally. So the Pipers, they swept the Indiana Pacers. Now, what was interesting about the Indiana Pacers was that was the team that was the most organized team when the league started. They had the best ownership. They had the best general manager. They really had their stuff together when the league started, and they got off to a great – I mean, they had tryouts going in June. The Pipers never had anybody get together until September, until training camp. Most of the league was like that. So they already had a team pretty much by the time all the other teams began their practices. Right. So anyway, they got off to a great start. They had good ownership. And they had Roger Brown. That was the other guy with Connie that got, you know, nailed by that scandal. And Roger Brown was an exceptional forward. He was a good shooter, good passer, really good player, held that team together. Him and Freddie Lewis was their point guard. So they had a really good team, but they faded during the season, sort of came back to earth. And then at the very end, they signed a guy named Reggie Harding. Reggie Harding's worth another half hour, but let's just say Reggie Harding in the end was gunned down on the street corner. But Reggie Harding had a lot of issues. Great player. So anyway, they had to suspend Reggie Harding right before the playoffs started. So the Pacers were having all sorts of problems. And so the Pipers just ran all over them in three games. Then when they played the Muskies were a really good rebounding team, good defending team, but they were not real good shooting team. So, and the Pipers were a real good shooting team. They could rebound. You know, it's funny, probably 2/3 of the games during the entire season, the Pipers got out-rebounded, but their exceptional shooting, they would still win most of their games, even though and they would get out-rebounded big time in a lot of games, but still win. So the Pipers won in five. They might have swept, but game two, was the first playoff game. You know, they swept Indiana, won game one easily against Minnesota at home. And game two was at home, but game two should have never been played that night because Martin Luther King riots were going on. And literally a half a mile away from the arena, a riot had started. This was Saturday night, two nights after the assassination. So as soon as the game was over, it was every man for themselves, literally. Jim Jarvis told me about running through. He had his family there and how they had to run to their car and get it was pretty dicey there. So that game shouldn't have been played that night. And one thing I noticed, the Pipers were playing real well until about the third quarter, and then they collapsed. And I'm thinking, and I haven't asked anybody yet, but I think word started getting around that, hey, there was trouble right outside. Yeah, sure. And so I think they were sort of in a hurry to get the game over. So they lost that game. They went to Minnesota and took care of business up there in two games and then came back home, won game five. Now, ironically, Steve Vasendak, the number five guard who could have been the number two or number three, but because he had to go to Army training, well, he got called up by the National Guard after game two. So he was literally patrolling the streets instead of playing in games three, four, and five in that series. Now, the New Orleans Buccaneers were a very similar team to the Pipers. Good shooters, good passers, had some good rebounds. Red Robbins was a good rebounder. He was their starting center. So that was a real even match. Game one, Pipers had home court advantage. The Pipers beat them handily in game one, but then the Chico Vaughn gave New Orleans some bulletin board material. And so game two, the Buccaneers smacked them pretty good in Pittsburgh. Then game three down in New Orleans, the Pipers had a big lead and then blew it in the fourth quarter. So they fell behind 2-1, had to play game four on the road. And New Orleans had they played at the Loyola University Arena, a small venue, about 7,000, but it was loud. They got a bigger attendance than any other team during the playoffs. So Connie Hawkins went nuts in game four, scored 47 points. If you look at all the Pirates, World Series, Penguin Stanley Cup, Steelers Super Bowls, what Connie Hawkins did in games four and then game six. So they won game four. Connie Hawkins scored 47 points. Remember I said Charlie Williams and Chico sometimes got a little in love with the three-point shot? So the coach benched Charlie and Chico to begin the second half of that game four, put Steve Vasendak and Jim Jarvis in, said, give Connie the ball. They did. Connie scored 28 points. They won game four. Well, unfortunately, Connie hurt his knee real bad. So game five came up. Connie couldn't play. Game five, you know, it's 2-2 in Pittsburgh. The Pipers had the lead until late and then blew a lead. Buccaneers won 111-108, won game five. So Pipers had to go back down to New Orleans again, down 3-2. And once again, they weren't sure Connie was going to be able to play, but he did. And they, Connie scored 41 points. They won game six. And I forget the score. But, and game four, that one went to overtime. Larry Brown made a 3-point shot with 1 second left to tie it, but the Pipers still won it in overtime. And but then they go to back down game six. They weren't sure Connie was going to be able to play. He and the trainer, Alex Medich, which is, boy, we could spend a whole night talking about him. You talk about a Damon Runyon figure. But anyway, he helped get Connie ready to play. He played. He scored 41 points. They went back to Pittsburgh for game seven, played a perfect game through the first three quarters. Charlie Williams actually was the star game seven. He scored 35 points. Like I said, it was a perfect game through three, and then they sort of held on through the fourth quarter. And won the championship. And 11,000, that's another story about the playoffs. They had very disappointing crowds. They finally had Saturday night. So the first Saturday night playoff game was that game where a riot was going on. So that's one of the reasons Gabe Rubin didn't postpone the game, was because he was so desperate to have a Saturday night game.
Sure.
Seriously. And so then in the finals, they actually had three Saturday night games. They had disappointing crowds for games 1 and 5, but then game 7, the 11,000 people magically showed up. It was incredible. And they won. And then moved.
Yeah, then they moved. Well, and then moved. Mark, you, this has been a fascinating hour. I'm so happy you agreed to join. I can't wait till your book comes out. And I would love to have you back on. We could talk more about George Mikan. We could talk more about Connie Hawkins and so many of the others. I'd love to have you come back on, and I hope you'd consider it. And again, I really want to thank you for joining me this evening on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
All right. Well, thanks. It was a lot of fun.
Wow, what a story. The Pittsburgh Piper certainly had a very unique history, and I'm looking forward to having Mark back on to talk a little more about the Pipers and, of course, Connie Hawkins. Look for Mark's book towards the end of 2024. I'll have more info about it upon its release. Thanks again to Mark for sharing so much with us, and thanks to you for spending your time with us. And I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.